to passengers with the camera. If you are going to take photographs, can you please turn your flash off? It's most important on the underground. Can you turn your flash off when you use the camera? And next time, if you're going to take a photograph, can you ensure that I'm smiling, please?
G'day, I'm Erk, and welcome to episode number 2 of On the Rails with Erk, a personal look at all things railways, coming to you from Sydney, Australia. Hello, hope you enjoyed episode number 1, which was basically an overview of my career and a good starting point for what this podcast is going to be. In future weeks, I'll be expanding on some of the themes that I've started in episode number 1. But as always, this is a personal podcast, a personal look at all things railway, not necessarily the opinions of a particular operator. Language and terminology does vary from operator to operator, from around the world, and even within the same operator. Terminology does vary, so I'm going to try and keep it as general as I can, because we have hopefully a wide range of listeners, both from inside and outside the industry. If you are inside the industry and you would like to give me your opinions, I'll try and keep things as, impersonal as I can. You know, I don't want to identify anybody and necessarily get them in any trouble. You can leave a comment on the show notes at ontherailswitherk.com. Or indeed, you can send me an email, erkpod@gmail.com. If you're up to have a bit of a chat about your life on the railways as either a passenger or a member of staff, feel free to contact me via the website and we'll hook that in. I'm actually on annual leave at the moment for the next couple of weeks, so I thought this would be a good time to be in the studio and to record episode number 2 of On the Rails with Erk. Hello to everyone who said that they were going to subscribe after episode number 1. I know already that there's some people from inside and outside the industry listening, so hello. And of course, as we usually say with a lot of things internet, your mileage may indeed vary. You know, your story is different to mine. You might be working somewhere totally different to me. You know, you might be on a totally different type of train network than me, so it'll be interesting to see what happens in future weeks. On this episode, rather than continuing with some of the themes that we had in episode number 1 that I can go into at any time, I thought that I'd answer some frequently asked questions and that I'd answer them, pretty much. Now, you might be wondering how I can answer some frequently asked questions in episode number 2, but when you've been in the railway industry for as long as I have, and you know the amount of people that I do, there's always questions that seem to come up when you mention what you do for a job. And I dare say that that's nothing new to anyone. If you're an airline pilot and you happen to mention that at a party or a social gathering or online or whatever, of course you're going to get questions. Train drivers, the same thing. Firemen, same thing. Police officers, same thing. There's always some sort of public perception. There's also some sort of stereotype that goes in there. But I'm here to tell you some of my frequently asked questions and, more importantly, give you the answers to them. Of course, if you're out there listening and you would like to ask me a question, or if you would like to give your own answer, feel free to. You can leave a comment on the show notes. You can indeed leave a comment there, or you can send me an email, or indeed send me a voicemail via the website ontherailswitherk.com, or if you don't remember that, everything's under channelerk.com. So what are some of the things that I get asked on a regular basis? Now, of course, at the moment, I drive a train. Well, not currently this second, this moment, because I'm, as I said, I'm on annual leave. But when I am at my place of employment, of course, I drive a train. Now, some people get to see what it's like being up the front. You know, fellow members of staff, they know exactly what I'm talking about. They know exactly what I have to do. But there's some people out there who don't necessarily know the mechanics of of how to actually drive a train and what happens. So occasionally I'll get asked, how does this thing steer? How do you start it? How do you stop it? And on some occasions I've even had, sometimes from kids, and with kids I can sort of understand, but I've even had the question from adults, where's the steering wheel? And I think that the where's the steering wheel question might have actually started from the old days, here in Sydney at least, of the old ratchet handbrakes, where it sort of looks like a steering wheel. If you didn't know any better, you turn it one way or the other to release the parking brake, if you like. And so if you're a kid and you get into that particular carriage, or even some of the trailer cars had them in the passenger area, you might think, oh, like a racing car, you know, steering wheel. But that's not how it worked. Essentially, we go on tracks, so we don't necessarily have to steer ourselves. Some people, when there's been level crossing accidents, they have actually asked the question, how come the train driver did not swerve to avoid the car? And that, of course, is impossible. In a brief way, how it is controlled, there's a person, and again, terminology varies widely, a signal box or a signal cabin or a control center. Sometimes there's a manual lever which moves the rail from one track to another, and that basically enables you to steer. So sometimes I might tell people that, yeah, I drive the train, but there's actually someone else somewhere else that actually steers for me. So that is how it steers in some areas, like where I am in Australia, and a lot of the Australian operators are the same. You've got handles or levers which you use to control the brake and to control the power. In a street car in San Francisco, for instance, you've got an accelerator like a car. And again, in San Francisco, you've got the Bay Area Rapid Transit System, the BART system, where the train operator basically presses a button after the doors are closed, the train drives itself to the next station, and then when the train arrives at the next station, the operator opens and closes the door, presses the big red button again, and then off they go. And then, of course, in places such as Vancouver in British Columbia, you have totally automated trains in the SkyTrain. And I'd be interested to find out more about that from someone in the Canada who can tell me how that works. I did go on the SkyTrain when I was in Vancouver in 2009. It was an interesting system. I did pretend to drive the train because they don't have a separate driver's compartment. So you can see out the front window, so to speak, to get the view that I normally get. The same with the air train servicing JFK Airport in New York, same sort of thing. You can just see out the front because everything's automated, and you can just, you know, pretend to be a train driver all you want. So that's the how do you steer, how do you drive question. Another question that I often get asked is it hard? You know, you're just sitting there, is it hard? And I have to say that there's a lot of training involved where you get to the point where it looks easy. When I started, as I mentioned last week, I was a train guard first. And so my conversion from train guard, or what some people might call a conductor in America, to driver, or what some people might call engineer, was a 6-month process. The current process is more like 12 months. But in that 12-month period, you're extensively trained in places where you power, where you brake, where you coast. There's a lot of coasting that goes on, actually, when it comes down to it. There's a lot of places where you're just basically rolling like a roller coaster. You're using the hills and whatnot to control your movement either faster or slower. And sometimes that's exactly what it feels like. It feels like a roller coaster. A lot of us, we have different landmarks that we use. Depending on where we are, we might have a particular billboard or a particular bridge, a particular sign, a particular signal, for instance, that we might use as a point to either apply power or to shut off power or to start braking. Sometimes, according to the conditions and the type of train that you're driving, you might have to vary that somewhat, but it becomes automatic after a while and it does look easy. If you're just driving along and you power and then you get to a certain point and you stop powering and then you put on the brakes and then you stop at the station. But I can tell you from experience, it isn't easy when you start. And if you haven't done it for a while, it's a very difficult job in terms of concentration. You always have to be remembering where you are. Situational awareness is what some people call it. You have to be aware of your situation, how your train's handling. Are the rails greasy? Are they wet? Is it raining? What's your visibility like? You know, am I going uphill, downhill? Am I all stations or am I express? Because that can vary the way that you drive as well. You know, do I have a lot of passengers on board? Those sort of things. So there's lots of different little factors that you take into consideration when you're driving a train. And if you haven't seen someone drive a train before, they make it look easy. But I can tell you, rest assured, that it definitely is not easy at all. Hey, you. Yes, you, listening to this right now. Do you have anywhere to go?
I have nowhere else to go.
You do now. Come and check out Irk Pod, Irk's original talk podcast since 2007. News, politics, sport, religion. Yeah, maybe, maybe not. Just depends on what I feel like talking about on a particular day. If you like travel, no need to worry about full body massages or x-rays or scanning or late taxis to the airport. You can, from the comfort of your home, travel wherever I do. Come join me, Irk, on Irk Pod.
I have nowhere else to go.
Yes, you do. Come and listen to Irk Pod, part of Channel Irk, channelirk.com. Welcome back to On the Rails with Irk, episode number 2, talking about some of the things that I am asked on a regular basis. And another thing that I'm asked on a regular basis is, Irk, what time do you start work? And that's a very interesting question, because basically the way that I like to explain it is that there's 365 days a year. I could be working any one of those days a year. There's 24 hours in a day. I could be starting work at basically any time of the day or night. My earliest sign-on, I think, from memory, is about 1:30 in the morning. And the last sign-on, if there's nothing special going on the weekends, is about 8 or 9 p.m. And so, as a rule of thumb, just add 8 hours to that, although that's not necessarily the case. So, potentially, any minute of any day is a potential start time. My start times, they don't necessarily work on the way that they do, for instance, working on the stations. Where at a 24-hour station, for instance, you might have staff, say, signing on at 6 a.m., 2 p.m., and then 10 p.m. as an example. And so you have very set start times. They usually go for 8 hours. you might have the occasional station staff working overtime, and so they might be working for 12 hours. So they might be working their whole 8-hour shift plus 4 hours of someone else's. Whereas for me, it's highly regulated according to Acts of Parliament. And of course, this all varies from operator to operator and from location to location. But I am usually rostered anywhere between 7 hours and 8 hours and 33 minutes. And every one of those minutes is somehow accounted for. For instance, you might start work at, I'll just make this easy for the mass, 3 p.m. Or as we usually go in 24-hour time, you might start at 1500. So you sign on at 1500. You may be allowed 10 minutes to do everything that you need to do when you sign on. So things like filling in your timesheets, checking your rosters, finding out what trains you're on. And that's another topic in itself, you know, what trains you're on and how you find that out. So your 10 minutes is up, and then you might have 5 minutes to walk to your first train. So you've given from 1500 to 1510 to sign on, 1510 to 1515 to walk to your train. Now your train, your first train of the day, might arrive at say 1517. And then from 1517 until whenever your documentation says that you get off that train, you then basically follow the timetable. So in this example, you might be on the 1517 train. You might take it out of town for an hour. So say arrive at 1617, turn around for 10 minutes, so that's 1627. The 1627 brings you back into town again for the sake of the mass an hour later. And so that's 527 or 1727. So now you're sort of approaching the time where you sort of start to think about your meal break. And there's a range of times where your meal break can apply. And again, it's different between operators. So you might have a bit of a break, go on a train for a shorter distance. You know, you might have to go around the city circle or a city loop, something like that. Or you might have to wait for another train and then take it to a relief point, then have your meal break. And then once you have your meal break, get on another train and then get back to your sign-off point and then sign off. Everything, at least in my organisation and in other organisations, is highly, highly timetabled. You know, the old joke of the train drivers never read the timetable is so not true. You have to follow it pretty closely, and you have to follow what we call a diagram, which tells you all the trains that you're going to be on. So your time for your meal breaks are all accounted for. Your time of walking between trains is accounted for. If you're getting a train ready at the start of the shift or midway through the shift, as in some cases, or if you're putting the train to bed, and of course I realise that I'm using some layperson terms here, all of that time is timetabled. How long it takes you to actually sign off, all of that is accounted for. So some shifts, you might start at, you know, 1500. It might be a nice round figure where you go, oh, okay, I'm starting at 1500. So today I might be starting at 1500. Tomorrow I might be starting at 1427. That's right, I said 1427. That's how precise it gets with your start times. 1427 on, and say you might be off at 2227 if it's a straight 8 hours. But it might not be a straight 8 hours. It might be 8 hours 33 or 8 hours 21 or 7 hours 15 or whatever. As long as you work your minimum time and as long as you don't go over your maximum time, you can be working at any stage through there. So what I do, and other people have various ways of doing this, is on my iPhone I've got my calendar. And so what I'll do, I'll put in my start time, and I'll put the diagram number into my phone. And effectively, I have an 8-hour block, which I use if I want to basically roughly work out what time I'm finishing. I'll just add 8 hours to the start time, although that's not necessarily true. And so for every day, you'll have, oh, okay, start at 1500. So by rights, I should be finished at about 2300. Should be. Around about that time. Sometimes it's an hour, you know, an hour before that. So yeah, actually might be finished at 2200. Sometimes you might be finishing as late as 2330 for that example. And if you're not there at that start time, like 14:27, if you're not there within a certain period of you actually needing to be there, the people who sign you on have got every right to ring you up and say, hey, Irk, where are you? You're not here. We need you here. And, you know, that does happen from time to time. Same too, if you're in the middle of your shift and... We'll go on to the next question in a later episode, because I think that the big elephant in the room, so to speak, of why does my train run late, I think that could have an episode dedicated to itself. Another question that I get asked often is, can you do something about the air conditioning? It's not working, it's too hot, it's too cold. You know, can I, as the driver, do something about it? And in most cases, unfortunately, the answer is no. I can't do anything about it. In many of the trains, the air conditioning is either on or it is off. Now, of course, some trains in some areas aren't air conditioned at all. And so if you are in a train that's not air conditioned, you'll have windows that'll open. But there's nothing I can do about it. If your train doesn't have air conditioning, I can't tell you anything about, you know, what to do, you know, how you can make things better, because you're in a non-air conditioned train. It doesn't matter what you do, where you sit, it will be non-air conditioned. One basic thing of science to remember, especially if you're in a double-deck train, hot air rises. And so if you're in a non-air conditioned train, it might be better in a double-deck train to sit downstairs. But assuming that you are in an air-conditioned train and you say that it's either too hot or too cold, a lot of the temperature is actually controlled in many cases from a maintenance level. It's not necessarily something that the train crew can actually deal with. What might help you from time to time is if you actually change locations in the carriage. You could, for instance, be sitting right underneath an air conditioning vent. And so if you're sitting right underneath the vent and it's coming out, the air's coming out from the air conditioner, you might be a bit sensitive to that. So if you move, you might find that that works a little bit better. Sometimes, of course, the air conditioner is faulty, and so many of the carriages indeed have two air conditioners, so if it's not working at one end, it may indeed be working from the other. And of course, if it's not working at all, I definitely want to know about it. Again, if you find that you're too hot, you know, it might be a case of, again, moving to somewhere else in the carriage. Sometimes as well, if you are closer to the train doors, you can find that the air conditioning is not necessarily as effective, because you're constantly getting cold or hot air in and out as the doors open and close and people come in and out. So if you're particularly susceptible to changes in temperature, you might find that somewhere in the middle of the carriage might be better for you. But indeed, if it's not working at all, I definitely want to know about it. And experience can lead you to a good spot on a particular train. Of course, some days it's just so difficult to try and get the air conditioning right, because they try and average it out. But if you have a really, really hot day or a really, really cold day and it's not within the normal range, well, of course, that's going to be difficult. You know, there's some conditions that air conditioners aren't designed for. For instance, when I was in America earlier this year, early in 2013, there was a day here where it was 46 or 48 degrees Celsius. So it was like 115, 120 degrees Fahrenheit. And it doesn't matter how good the air conditioning is on a day such as that. You know, it's always going to be difficult on a day like that. Many of these air conditioners, many of these trains are working up to 24 hours a day. And so if it gets too hot, of course, things start to shut down, unfortunately. But that's just one of the perils that sometimes happens in a environment where it does get really, really hot. And that day in particular, I remember I was actually on an Amtrak train, long-distance passenger train in America. It was the Sunset Limited. I was on my way from Los Angeles and I was heading to New Orleans. And I remember reading on Facebook, a lot of people were saying, oh man, it is so hot. The trains are running so late. The air conditioning's not working. It is just so hot. It's just so unbearable. And I was really lucky that I missed that. I was a lot more comfortable on my Amtrak train, but I can just imagine how it would have been. I know that some of my passengers are on the train for, you know, maybe an hour at a time, maybe a little bit longer. You get some that are on the train for maybe 10 minutes, if that, in each direction. Whereas my train crewing buddies may indeed be on that train for up to 4.5 hours at a time. So in circumstances like that, I definitely know what you're going through down the back.
Rooty Tooty Hill, Wagga 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 Wagga.
So, of course, that is some of the frequently asked questions. I'll go on to some more on the next episode, including how do you get a job? And why is my train late? They're two questions that I'm commonly asked. If you have any questions that you would like to ask or indeed give the answer to, or give your experience of the answer to, you can leave a comment on the show notes at channelerk.com, on therailswitherk.com, episode number 2. There's a voicemail facility on that website, and also you can send me an email, erkpod@gmail.com. Of course, as always, this is a personal podcast and not necessarily reflecting those of any particular operator. Anywho, I'm Erk. I hope you've enjoyed that. It gives you some discussion points, something to think about. And I'll be back next time, not necessarily next week. I'll be back next time on The Rails with Erk. Until next time, I'm Erk. Thank you for listening. This episode terminates here. Good night, Interweb.
Due to defective brakes, the next train does not stop at this platform. Intending passengers should board this train by running down the platform. Doors may not be opened.